May it please the Court, my name is Joel Austin, and I'm an attorney for the defendant appellant, Mr. Jason Schrake. Jason appeals his conviction under Count 1 for distribution of child pornography and under Count 2 for possession of child pornography. The issues presented in this case are a first impression in this and any federal appeals court. Jason requests that this court reverse or remand his case for at least the following three reasons. First, an overbroad definition of child pornography was invoked under both Section 3509M and the sentencing guidelines in violation of the First Amendment. Second, Jason's sentence is unreasonable in relation to the evidence presented and the policies underpinning the sentencing guidelines. And third, Section 3509M imposes restrictions on evidence that are in violation of the Fifth and Sixth Amendments. Under the First Amendment, Section 2256.8b is unconstitutional because it includes
I don't understand why any of this matters. Maybe I shouldn't say any of this. But this is just a rule dealing with pretrial discovery. It doesn't penalize the possession of any particular materials. Your First Amendment argument treats this as if it were a penal statute, but it's not. It's a rule about pretrial discovery. Therefore, I don't see how, even in principle, the First Amendment can have anything to do with it.
You're correct in the fact that it is a discovery statute that...
Exactly. So suppose this were the Jenks Act, or a variant of the Jenks Act, and it says, here are statements of investigators that you can or cannot get in discovery. The fact that the investigators' statements contain no pornography at all, you know, they're completely factual. They describe the world. Doesn't mean you've got a First Amendment problem with the Jenks Act. Isn't that perfectly straightforward? The fact that the material you can't get in discovery would be itself covered by the First Amendment is irrelevant to the discovery question. Otherwise, you think Rule 16, the Jenks Act, everything is unconstitutional. It just can't possibly be relevant.
I would submit as well that the definition, the overbroad definition of child pornography also shows up in several other aspects of Jason's case.
You started off by saying that this is a case of first impression and so on, but as I understand it here, the procedures spelled out in this act are really taken from opinions of a couple of circuits, the Fifth and the Eighth, that outline this procedure. Now it's codified, so everybody follows it. So technically this might be a case of first impression, but we do have some pretty substantial circuit law, nothing to the contrary, that casts any doubt on the efficacy of this program.
I believe that the two cases that were perhaps referenced in the government's briefs both allowed broader access to the evidence than are permitted under Section 3509.
But what access didn't you have? That stuff was in Milwaukee. Yeah. Your expert is in Milwaukee. Could have come over there any time, couldn't he?
Unfortunately, I believe the expert was required to go to Madison to view the evidence.
But the evidence was in Milwaukee. But even if...
Correct. But the government...
If you knew how many people drive from Milwaukee to Madison for Badger games every Saturday during the fall, I mean, it's not like having to go to New Delhi.
Correct. It was...
I think it violates the Due Process Clause to require people to go from Milwaukee to Madison merely to see football. Another way of putting this question, counsel, is to say the statute itself says the government can hold on to this, quote, so long as the government makes the property or material reasonably available to the defendant, close quote. Well, you can't raise a constitutional challenge to a statute that itself requires reasonable availability. So the only question would be whether the statute was complied with, not whether the statute is constitutional.
Perhaps...
Was there any argument that the material was not made reasonably available?
Yes. Some of the evidence submitted at trial, specifically the defense expert complained that there were several... The best example is there were several images that the defense expert was unable to access given the government's equipment because it didn't have the appropriate codecs to view...
All right. Well, did you raise that with the district court?
There were numerous occasions. I don't believe that specific incident was brought up with the district court, but there were several motions that did question and ask the court to look at how this examination of the evidence was being conducted and ask for broader access to this evidence.
Look, I asked you for an example of stuff that wasn't reasonably available. And you gave me an example that you say was never raised with the district court, and so it's hard to see how you can complain about the judgment. Is there some shortfall of reasonable availability that was raised with the district court and not resolved satisfactorily? Because that might actually be a basis for an attack on the judgment.
I don't have anything to cite to at this point, no.
I could certainly see an argument that if the government did not have the codecs necessary to view certain files, the district court would be authorized to compel the government to buy them or license them so that your expert could see it. But if no such request is ever made to the district court, it's awfully hard to see how there was a reversible error, or indeed any error.
Correct. And unfortunately, we're dealing with the facts as they were in the district court. But, you know, perhaps some of the other burdens that are placed on a defendant due to the implications of...
Of course, if the government didn't have the codecs, the government couldn't have looked at the pictures or movies either. Or how would they know whether they were pornographic?
Correct, but I believe the evidence is very contextual in these types of cases when you're dealing with electronic evidence. Perhaps it's not the same as other tangible evidence that we're traditionally used to dealing with. For example, the electronic evidence, you need to not only, specifically in child pornography cases, the evidence is the crime itself. It contains time stamps, date stamps, when was it downloaded, when was it viewed, was it deleted from the main portion of the computer into this unallocated space. So I think access to this type of evidence is somewhat different than we're typically used to. And the restrictions of Section 3509M unnecessarily hamper a defendant's ability to gain access to that evidence in order to prepare.
Your brief says that the government's computers had roughly a different forensic examination system than your experts. And the forensic examination system is what you would use to examine changes in the disk directory, which tells you which files, which sectors are allocated and which were not, and when they were deallocated. Was there any request made to the district judge to require the government to purchase a copy of your favored expert's forensic software or to license a copy so that it could be used in the prosecutor's office?
No, not that I'm aware. There was a request for the expert to be able to use his own equipment and bring it in, and that request was denied the government.
Obviously it was going to be denied. In part because the material, if it's reasonably available on the government's machine, can't be put on somebody else's. But it sounds increasingly like your predecessor, you were not trial counsel, your predecessor just didn't make the right requests of the district court to take advantage of the statute.
Perhaps we could talk about Jason's sentence for a moment. I think with respect to his sentence, it's unreasonable for at least two reasons. First, three unidentified videos were erroneously included in the sentencing calculations. And second, the mechanical application...
Before we go there, there's one other issue about the application of 3509, and that's the question whether the government violated 3509 by making copies of this for its own expert. How was that question raised in the district court?
The trial counsel did have issue with that. The response from the government was that the expert was being paid by the government and therefore became an agent of the government.
My question is, how was it raised? That is, what kind of motion was made? Was it a motion to give the defendant's expert the same access that the government's expert had? Was it some other kind of request made of the district court?
I believe it was in respect to the desire to have the testimony of the government's expert prohibited from being introduced.
You wanted to suppress for that. That doesn't seem like the remedy.
It seems less likely as a remedy than the remedy saying, give us the same access you gave that person.
Correct.
That's why I'm asking whether that request was ever made.
Yes. I mean, numerous times we asked for additional access to the evidence, whether or not we asked for the same as the government.
I'm asking a very concrete question. Was the district judge ever asked to give the defendant's expert access on identical terms to that which the government's expert had? No more, no less.
The short answer is no. The defense did ask to have a copy of the evidence, which essentially would have been the same access that the government's expert had, and the fact that she was sent a copy and had unlimited access and possession of the evidence to review it at her leisure as many times as she deemed necessary. If I could touch on two things real quickly with the sentencing, and then I'll reserve the remaining time. In calculating Jason's sentence, three unidentified videos were included to increase his sentencing. And I believe that the situation presents the same impropriety noted by this court in U.S. v. B., in which the lower court attempted to increase B's sentence based on facts that were neither jury-proven nor defendant-admitted. And I believe clearly that this type of sentencing enhancement affects Jason's substantial rights. The second reason his sentence is unreasonable is due to an anomaly uncovered by the application of the sentencing guidelines to Jason's particular situation. In essence, the problem is that Jason actually received a longer sentence by grouping his two counts than he would have if each count would have been calculated independently. Specifically, even in including the three unidentified videos, grouping the counts leads to a sentence that is approximately 3.5 to 4.5 years longer than had they been calculated separately. Ironically, grouping was actually deemed necessary to increase incremental sentencing enhancements and to prevent absurd sentencing results. This is made clear in the policy statements provided by the sentencing guidelines. I quote, when a defendant engages in conduct that causes several harms, each additional harm, even if it increases the extent to which punishment is warranted, does not necessarily warrant a proportionate increase in punishment. The sentencing guidelines go on to state that these rules may produce occasional anomalies, but that the rules seek to provide incremental punishment for significant additional criminal conduct, and the amount of punishment should decline as the number of additional offenses increases. And therefore, I believe it's clear that Jason's sentence creates the occasional anomaly that the guidelines warn of, and is precisely the type of situation that this court is empowered to correct. With that, I would like to reserve my remaining time for rebuttal.
I have one more question about your predecessor's strategy or lack thereof. Was there any objection made in the district court to the reference to the three additional videos to which the pre-sentence report referred?
We were unable to locate any reference in the record to the three videos until they showed up in the PSR.
That's not my question. My question is, did the defense object to the district court considering them?
No.
Okay, thank you. Ms. Altman.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, my name is Elizabeth Altman, and I represent the United States in this case. I also represented the United States in the trial of the defendant at the district court level. 3509M provides a defendant with ample opportunity for inspection and analysis of child pornography. Therefore, the statute is constitutional on its face. In this case, the defendant was provided the opportunity to inspect the images, and he did not take advantage of that access. Additionally,
I'm worried, counsel, about the differential access between the government's expert and the defense expert. We know from cases like Weatherford against Bercy that there's no constitutional right to discovery in criminal cases. But we also know from Wardius against Oregon that any discovery rights have to be reciprocal. They have to put the defendant and the prosecutor on the same basis. And it looks like this statute, at least as it was administered here, was not reciprocal. It put the prosecution and the defense on a very different basis. Now, why should that be allowed?
Well, as administered here, perhaps it's easiest to see in looking at a timeline of how the events occurred in this case to see how it was fairly administered here. The main thing with how it was administered here is the defendant did not take advantage of the escape clause, which provided for the images to be turned over to him if we hadn't provided the ample opportunity. The defendant was first charged...
Are you just trying to paraphrase the statutory term?
I am.
We should probably stick with the statutory term.
Sure.
Makes the property or material reasonably available to the defendant.
Correct. And he never filed a motion requesting an ample, requesting or indicating that we had not provided an ample opportunity and requesting more access.
Availability is what the statute says.
Okay. I'll use those terms. He never requested a copy of the hard drive. What happened was the defendant was first charged in September of 2005. After various motions, competency examinations, etc., he was allowed to withdraw his plea. And on September 25th of 2006, this case was set for trial. He first requested the data from the hard drive on October 4th of 2006. He first complained in writing about the access his expert would have to the images on October 25th of 2006. And in that letter, he indicates, further, should the government rely on any recent amendments to 18 U.S.C. 3509 in prohibiting complete expert access to the data, I will need to promptly file a motion challenging such as to not delay this trial. So we know that he knew at that time what he needed to do to get more access. According to his expert's report, he reviewed the data in the U.S. Attorney's Office on November 1st and November 2nd of 2006. That was the last we heard about it. In no part of November did he say, you know, that wasn't enough access, I want more. At no part of December did he indicate anything about needing more access, about having insufficient access. It wasn't until January that we heard for the first time that he was concerned about the review in this case. And at that point, he still didn't ask for more access. What he did was he filed his expert's designation requesting...
I'm not sure I understand the significance of the November, December, January dates in the abstract. Where were these on the Rule 16 timeline? Was he acting within the time for making requests under Rule 16, or are you saying he was acting outside the time for making discovery requests under Rule 16?
My point is that for 2 months...
Within or without?
Within. He was within.
So he was within the time under Rule 16. So what difference... What's the significance of November and January if his request, when it came, was timely under Rule 16?
He never made a request to have further access. He filed a motion requesting suppression of our expert, and he filed an expert designation saying his expert had certain things, but he never said the government, he never said, please turn over a copy of the hard drive. There was never a formal hearing on whether or not that should occur. He never requested a copy of the hard drive after having reviewing it in November. When he finally did indicate that he was having issues with the access, he did it in the improper way by filing the motion to suppress the government's expert. And that's not the remedy that the statute provides for. Because he didn't request the additional access, he can't now say the statute was unconstitutionally applied to him. Additionally, the defendant can't show prejudice, which would be required for there to be an applied problem. Someone in the defendant's home entered a chat room called Preteen Baby and Toddler Sex and had a conversation with an undercover agent about trading child pornography. That same person later sent an agent videos of the child pornography. Jason Trake was later shown a copy of the conversation. He admitted that he was the other party in the conversation. He admitted that he sent the images to the undercover agent, and he said that there would be additional child pornography on his computer and possibly on some CDs that were found in his house. The evidence of guilt is overwhelming, and the statute was constitutionally applied to the defendant. Now, looking at the facial constitutionality, it's essentially a codified protective order. They've been used for years in child pornography cases. As detailed in the government's brief, this statute withstands all the attacks against it regarding facial constitutionality, and every court that has considered it so far has found that to be the case. A statute can be facially invalid only if there's no set of circumstances under which the act would be valid, and that simply isn't the case here. And I would rest on my brief addressing each of the constitutional claims, facial constitutional claims made by the defendant. I'd also rest on my brief regarding the sufficiency of the trial evidence. And unless the court has no further questions, I'd just like to make 2 points regarding sentencing. First, the defendant's guideline range was properly calculated. The three videos in question were properly counted. They weren't unidentified. They had names. They were identified in the pre-sentence report. There was no objection below. Had there been, they would have been shown to the judge, who would have then made the determination that the defendant is now seeking. And the description of them in the PSR was sufficient evidence for the number of images. And second, with regard to grouping, this also was not raised below, and nor was it raised in the opening brief. Should therefore be waived. But if this court considers it, 3D1.2 specifically says that 2G2.2, which covers the offenses in this case, are to be grouped. They were properly grouped. The guideline range was properly calculated, and the sentence is reasonable. I would respectfully request both it and the defendant's convictions be affirmed.
Mm-hmm. Did you want to speak to the reasonableness of the sentence, Ms.
Lennon? I believe that it is reasonable, Your Honor. It was within the guideline range. The court took into consideration many things. This defendant in particular had an extremely long history as far as long goes in the Western District of Wisconsin. He had numerous psychological reviews.
When you say long history of what?
Our cases generally don't last a year and a half. Our cases are generally, I think we're known as the Rocket Docket, are done in 10 weeks. This defendant, by virtue of issues that he raised, was before our court for a long time.
Maybe I'm not tracking.
My point is that this court had lots of information.
I'm suggesting that his sentence properly went up because he was a vigorous defendant, and that can't possibly be right.
That's absolutely not what I'm suggesting. What I'm suggesting is that the district court had more information before it on this defendant than it normally has on most defendants, and that it properly considered all the information before it in imposing the sentence.
Well, he draws some comparison to sentences that have been given in other cases
and
suggests that his background doesn't merit. That's the point I was trying to have you speak to.
My only response to that is that the other cases that he mentions, as far as I could tell, were all guideline sentences as well.
Yes, I don't think there's any question that this is within the guideline. I guess it's just the severity as compared to other cases that have had allegedly similar backgrounds.
The only thing I can say in response to that is apparently they were not similar in that the guideline ranges were that much lower. I'm familiar with the guideline ranges and the sentences in those other cases. I'm not familiar with the history, but if there was a lower guideline range, there had to be some difference. They didn't get enhancements for delivery or enhancements for using children under the age of 12 or all of the enhancements that Mr. Schrake got. If they had, obviously the guideline ranges would have been higher.
Thank you, Ms. Altman. Anything further, Mr. Austin?
First, just regarding the sentence, you're correct. Something does seem a tad out of place. He actually received 240 months under count one for distribution of two videos totaling 14 seconds. As far as the evidence goes, we did request below multiple times in the record for additional access. On October 2nd, record 108, we asked for a mirror image of the hard drive, which was practiced prior to the enactment of the act. And then at record 114, relatively close to trial, we again noted that our limited access to the evidence was causing us issues. Lastly, I'd like to just point out that the overbroad definition that we believe of child pornography also came up in multiple aspects of Jason's case. It was not only incorporated under Section 3509M, but also is included in the sentencing guidelines. The term images also includes the definition of Section 2256.8B. With that, I see my time is up. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, Mr. Austin. And we appreciate your willingness and that of your law firm to accept the appointment in this case and the assistance you've been to the court as well as to your client. The case is taken under advisement.